Blog Talk Radio.
Do you believe that America has become too politically correct? Von Wiehunt speaks truth to power. Do you see the coming of our political and economic demise? Von Wiehunt speaks bluntly about the need to correct America's course quickly. And now, broadcasting from the Eagle's Nest, a man who makes no excuses for putting America first. Here's your host, Von Wiehunt the Barbarian.
Song America, we are always a world at war. America as it was intended for ourselves and our posterity. This is Epic Episode 75 tonight, and the great theme is Who Murdered Elvis? We have a special treat for you tonight. We have the author, Stephen Ubaney. We'll be coming on the show tonight talking about his hit book and his trio of other books and Who Murdered FDR, Who Murdered Diana. But tonight, it's about Who Murdered Elvis Presley. Las Vegas, cash, chicks, the mob, an alleged hit, and more. Stay tuned, folks. Put your crash helmet on. Strap yourselves in. It's going to be a wild and crazy night. It's going to be a good one. I can't wait to talk about it. You've been watching the news and the election. Virginia went red. New Jersey has been stolen, as predicted on my show. Yeah, at about 3 to 5 o'clock in the morning, they always find those trucks with thousands and thousands of Democrat ballots, don't they? Seems to be the modus operandi of the Democrat Party, the demon rats. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. It's Ephesians 6:12. We do wrestle, and we do struggle against them. Some call them the deep state. Well, they're out there, and they manifest themselves in all kinds of ways. You know, this whole thing about COVID that's been going on, part truth, part hoax. The hysteria is what the government and the media like. They want you all to be scared to death. They want you to wear 4 or 5 masks and take 4 or 5 booster shots. In fact, they want you to take COVID shots for in perpetuity until the end of time. Reach one, many doctors say, lowers your vast immunity system, your natural immunity, if you will, to combat disease. It all makes sense once you realize that they want to kill us all. It's just so weird how the Biden regime waited until 2 days after the Virginia and New Jersey elections to drop their vaccine mandate rules, almost as if they know on cue that it's extremely unpopular. Now, a quote came out by Representative Pat Fallon of the Texas, who said that Joe Biden, get this, is facilitating the largest modern-day human trafficking operation in the United States today. And your tax dollars are funding it, per the Texas rep. He's probably right. Allegedly, we have to throw that in. We don't know for sure. But folks, we're so glad you're here tonight. If you're a new caller, This is a show for you tonight. Who Murdered Elvis? It's going to be incredible with the author, Stephen Ubaney. Now, it's now apparent that these products in the bloodstream from whatever Moderna, Pfizer type of vaccine, quote unquote, you're talking about, are toxic to many humans. In my view, an immediate halt to the vaccination program is required, is demanded with the facts on the ground, while an independent and verifiable and vetted safety analysis is undertaken to investigate the full extent of the harms to the American people. An immediate halt to the vaccination program is required. It's just too many stories of people taking the vaccine and falling over dead or having terrible, terrible side effects. You can say what you want, but and you can think what you want. But I always say, if you're running a nation, and if they don't do the obvious in the face of many stories, and they go the other direction, and they can't wait to vaccinate your children, even your unborn child or a newborn child, they're talking about that. They can't wait to get to your kids surreptitiously. They brag on TikTok, other social media, how they're going to get your kids. They're going to knock them out at a pep rally, and they're going to inoculate them. All kinds of crazy stories that are out there in videos, some by teachers, some by administrators, if you will, some by militants in the Democrat demon rat party. Just go online. You can find them all for yourself, as I did. There's hundreds of them. This is a religion to these people, this vaccine. COVID's the best thing in some ways that ever happened to them. But they went too far, as they always do in Virginia. Literally bitch slapped them all with that state going red in all the top positions. Governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. Look, I always tell you folks that the Democrat Party and the deep state and the UN, all these globalist type groups of whatever color or diversity, whatever you want to call it, they always overplay their hand. And that, my friends, is their Achilles heel. That is their prime weakness. That is where they are vulnerable. I'm proud of my country. We stand shoulder to shoulder with all of our friends and real allies. As I tell you folks on this show, there is no such thing as too many Labrador retrievers, guns, or motorcycles, or urban assault vehicles. So you have one life to live, my fellow Americans, and nationalists, and independents, and libertarians, and even some real conservatives and not cuck-servatives, because you all know at the end of the day that Trump won the election. But in America today, the era of the big media, big corporate media, big rhino talk show hosts with their millions of dollars of corporate sponsors who water down what they tell you, it's all about optics. It's all about how things look. It's not about the underlying asset. It's all about power. It's all about window dressing, nothing more. On our show, we go deep down the rabbit hole of the most shows, 99.9%, are deathly afraid to go down. How dare you, they say, talk about these things and make us all look bad, Von Wehunt. Well, I say, I'm a real patriot. You're not. And you can talk a big game. We will go where no show has gone before. We will leave no stone unturned in our quest, our epic quest, if you will, for a better and a more valiant and a stronger nation and a stronger people. See, Biden and the Democrats want to weaken you. They want to weaken your mind. They want to scare you to death. I am the exact opposite. I want America so strong that nobody would dare invade us, that nobody would dare attack us. I want the people so strong they don't need the government for sustenance, for a check even. I want our nation so strong so other nations will tremble and shake violently at the thought of an American strike against their corrupt regime. We want the world to be afraid again of America. Yes, very afraid. So I tell you all, never apologize in life for who you are or what you do or what you represent. You are all wonders of this earth to be gazed upon with awe and envy. Be loud and be proud of who you are. To hell with Biden and the globalists and people that ilk. They are all vermin swine. The conquered nations will fall at your feet. We are the new gladiators of the digital age. We are the digital warriors. We are the talk show conquistadors and Roman centurions. As we ride into town, into each venue, in our Roman chariots, our legions, we're growing by leaps and bounds. It's a testament to how successful the show is. And I am in tune, unlike the so-called leaders in Washington, D.C. Von Wehan and my callers are the smartest in the world. And we are in tune with what's really going on in the gridirons of America, the farms, the ranches, the small towns, the big cities, and the mid-sized cities, the suburbs and the exurbs. I am in tune with it all, for I am comfortable talking to a pauper, to a farmer, to a rancher, to an office desk jockey, to kings and presidents. I'll talk to them all, and we will, and I will, speak truth to power. Now, many of you missed our show on Tuesday night. You would have had lots of time to talk and call in. Always catch The Bachelor's Guide to the Galaxy. It's our once-a-month fun show that we have the first Tuesday of every month. And it's the retro and modern-day Bachelor Guide for the new Renaissance men of the millennium and beyond. Great show, great callers, lots of fun. We play some music. But tonight, on our regular Thursday show, this is the serious show. We are broadcasting all over the nation, and we're in 15 countries. We're in the UK. We're in Europa. We're in Germany, of course. We're in Italia. I am German-Italian. We're in Australia. We're in Thailand, South Africa, even in Yemen. That must be a CIA substation, I always say. We're in Pakistan. Again, probably CIA. We're in Eastern Europe, Spain, Ireland, Canada, our northern neighbor, even Brazil, South America, and other parts of South America. Love the show. We have friends down there. A quick reminder, I would tell you during the monologue here, that your ancestors didn't mine pits and build ships and develop weapons, cross vast oceans, tamed immense jungles, designed bridges and really cool engineering things, erected castles, my God, composed symphonies, and painted masterpieces for kings and queens and courts and for the people for millennia. They didn't do all that for an influx of people from the third world. Now, no one can say that America is not the most generous country, which we are, for immigration. But no nation and no country can stand millions upon millions of people coming to our nation constantly. It'll be like Rome. It'll be the end of our nation. You see it now, don't you? All the different names. You walk into a mall, you hear 20, 30 different languages sometimes in some American cities. It's like the Tower of Babel, for God's sakes. I'll spell it out for you. We didn't do all that for the third world so a guy from Iraq could come over here, or Afghanistan refugees, or rebels, or Taliban. We didn't do it for the Arabs. Hate to burst your bubble. We didn't do it for the Africans. Hate to burst your bubble. We didn't do it for Mexico or Central America. We did not do it for Asia and millions of Chinese that are infiltrating China. I mean, California, same thing now. Almost pre-positioned for some Red Dawn invasion. Eerie. I have friends out in L.A. in Huntington Beach, and they go, there's so many Chinese people here. It's unbelievable. Am I in Beijing or Huntington Beach, California? And I tell them, you're really in both. Because the Chinese generals have said the only thing separating us from coveting America is an ocean. And we're working on transversing that right now as we speak. In other words, we didn't do all these great things in the Western so-called democracies for those people. We did it for our offspring. We did it for our posterity. Our ancestors did it for you and me. As I always start the show, we did it for our posterity, for our happiness, for ourselves. Now, that doesn't sit right with some people. Well, that's not my problem. They have a personal problem that they have to work out themselves. And then right now, the facts, they own 146,000 plus acres of American farmland. Smithville Foods and Hams and Nathan's Hot Dogs, of all things, and Armour Foods are all communist Chinese owned. These are foods that you should boycott, in my view. And yes, I said boycott. I hope they all go down the drain. America also needs to shut down all mosques and ban Islam. It's not good for the country long term. We are not a Muslim nation. It was a Christian nation for hundreds of years. It's not the time to be trying to convert America into the rubble of Afghanistan or Pakistan or Iraq. It's not what we should be doing. We had our nuclear sub brought back from the South China Sea, which was damaged in the front hull. I think somebody was asleep at the switch because the Navy said they ran into an underground, what's called a seamount, which is naval lingo I heard for a mountain. Who was piloting that naval sub? They should be in front of Congress testifying. That is another extension of how the military says they're woke and they're far more concerned about transgender bathrooms and where to place them on our nuclear subs than actually piloting the nuclear sub itself. That's where America's at, on the military front, if you will. Far more concerned about wokeism and things like that, transgenderism in the military, dumbing down the requirements, bringing in people that have no business being in the military. Now, when my father was in the military, you were brought in to kill people and to break things and to bomb things. That's just the way it was. My father actually lied about his age when he was 16, said he was 18. Back in 1948, and the recruiter winked at my dad and said, I know your family, son. I'm going to bring you in, and I know you will be a good warrior. My dad said the officer had a Texas draw, brought him in, and my father fought in Korea and Vietnam, there for the Tet Offensive. Saw lots of action, came back and worked out some of his issues and problems. He had PTSD like many soldiers. I do feel for them and their families. So they're out there, and they do need your support and our prayers, of course. You know, October 1st, a little while ago, we had the four-year anniversary of the Las Vegas massacre. We don't forget about that on my show. It's been real hush-hush, hasn't it? You bring it up online and very murky, very dark, almost like the fog of war in Vietnam or the movie Apocalypse Now, right? We had that four-year anniversary because October 1st, 2017 was the massacre. And it just is amazing what happened. 60 dead Americans, 867 injured. I don't believe any of the official narrative or stories. The real motive remains unknown. But yeah, our media in America, they keep endlessly hyperventilating and harping and bitching about January 6th. If they never, ever talked about the dead Americans and injured Americans just 4 years ago, the Las Vegas massacre in front of the Mandalay Bay Hotel Casino. It barely gets a peep on the back page of the New York Times. Nobody wants to talk about it. Operation Mockingbird, probably with the CIA, they went to purge that story, act like it never happened, and go on about our business. Well, no, I posted many of the photographs on my Gab account, and they're out there for all to look at. The dead bodies in front of Mandalay Bay. Go to gab.com, and you'll see them on my site. Type in the Von Wien Show. A lot of censored photographs have come to light because of that. Well, folks, you have reached the Radio Octagon and the Von Wien Show. It's now time for one of our promos.
The Von Wehunt Show. Conversation and analysis of breaking news, geopolitical events, politics, history, and some fun, too. Von Wehunt is an astute observer of the human condition. Von Wehunt will cut through the political correctness and speak bluntly about the social, political, and economic demise taking place in America and around the world. Von Wehunt is a nationalist who, without shame, puts America first. Von Wehunt, the barbarian. Thursday at 8 p.m.
I've always been the barbarian on the radio, damn right. It's my moniker and nobody else's. Never forget that. One more reminder, my fellow Americans, your congressmen are your representatives, not your kings, not your princes, and not your real leaders. They are your representatives. They lead only by your consent. If you don't consent, they're not your leaders, are they? That is how our Constitution was written back in the day. Take back your power. If you don't like who's repping your area, then get them the hell out of there. Vote in somebody new, somebody that you like. People will never cry out for communism without pain, it is said. The communists have always known this, and we have a very active communist party inside America. The commies even wrote about it. Everything they're doing, if you look at the current events, is with pain in mind. Physical pain, psychological pain, emotional pain, your pain, my pain. And they are hurting the nation on purpose. They know they have to shove America off a cliff and implode it from within for them to really seize control. You don't think it's possible? Many of you think that America will be here forever. I disagree with you. And I think the facts are on my side. Just look at the nation. The last decade, if you will, 20 or 30 years, it's disintegrating before your very eyes. I hate to say it. We've had one installed president after another, and all they seem to do is work off the same playbook. Trump being the brief blip on the radar screen that upset. He was the bull in the China shop, so to speak. And they got rid of him really fast. I was broadcasting on KFNX, and I told you all, there is no guarantee, keyword, guarantee, that Trump is going to win re-election. People thought I was crazy. They went, no, Von Wien, how can it be? Trump's in the bag, man. He's going to win. I said, I don't care if he wins by 100 million votes. He's not going to win the Oval Office. People thought I was nuts. I said, no, you wait. You wait. I'm the kind of guy that goes, you wait. You see. Just wait and see. And I'll make a damn believer out of you. Sure enough, what I thought was going to happen, happened. The Democrats pulled out every cheating stop to win. Ballots were found in trash bins and parked cars, for God's sakes. Even the drunk guy was pulled over by the police. And they found thousands of ballots, all for Biden. Isn't it always amazing that between 3 and 5 a.m., every ballot is for a Democrat, every ballot was for Biden. They don't even try to cheat cool and say leave 10% for Trump. No, every ballot. And the same thing happened in the state of New Jersey. I heard, it's not been vetted yet, that every ballot, they needed 45,000 ballots to win, the Democrats. And they magically found exactly 46,000 ballots from my intel. And every ballot, again, was for the Democrat candidate. Every ballot. That is statistically impossible. Statistics never lie, as the saying goes, but people do. That's where America is at today. That's our snapshot of where we're at. So my Viking brothers and sisters all over the world, the age of guilt is over. We will not apologize for our great achievements. Our history cannot and will not be used as a weapon against us. We are in debt to no one. Our glorious past is a matter of great pride and supreme joy to us. Whatever we have done in the past only inspires us today for even greater deeds tomorrow. Now, as you've heard, the Biden administration is considering payments of $450,000 per person to immigrant families that were separated after illegally crossing the border during the Trump administration. Can you read the writing on the wall? Do you see the signs? Our Biden government is literally paying to have all of us displaced and replaced by criminal foreign invaders, who they will pay, and you're funding it with your tax dollars. We will have to find out a way and figure out a way in some way at some point, the way this is going, to unify, organize, yes, organize, and put a stop to all of this. Or this will be the end of everything we've ever known and loved. Because we were here first. I'm sorry. America cannot absorb the world. And the world wants to come here. We know. We get it. We read the headlines. The Lügenpresse, the fake press. But one thing they have right, when they say that millions of people want to come here, that is a factoid. That is true. But what they mean when they print it, they want to demoralize you. I read and go, yes, that is true. That does not demoralize me. But the whole game of our corporate media and our corporate government via corporatism is to demoralize you, Mr. and Mrs. America. Demoralize you and make you feel that you're insignificant, that you don't count, that your vote doesn't count, that what you think and say doesn't count. And when I hear someone say this, I feel like slapping them. The government would never do that, they say. They would never do that. It's just laughable. I remind them of MK Ultra, Operation Northwoods, Operation Mockingbird, the poisoning of some cities like St. Louis, allegedly, Operation Jade Helm, and many, many other operations, and many that are on the books that we don't even know about, that are so top secret they've yet to be unleashed on the country. And the list goes on and on and on. Well, also this past week, the CEO of Blackstone warned that power shortages and riots are coming to developed nations soon. Propane shortages could leave rural country homes without heat this coming winter, and cities too. Now, also the maker of those big bunkers for the elites, right? They cost $5 million a pop. He said, business is good. Business is brisk. And what he meant was the elites are afraid of a rebellion forming in this nation. And that's his words in what they're thinking, what they're saying. So they're scrambling, not just the political, but even the people that have a lot of money. They could be whatever persuasion politically, but they're buying these underground bunkers. And they're being built all over the nation. They're going to go underground because they feel that civil unrest and a rebellion is forming. That is interesting news as well. Well, folks, we are in for one hell of a treat tonight. We've got the author, Stephen Ubaney, on the line waiting to come on. We're so glad you're here. Get your adult beverages ready. strap in your seat, put your crash helmet on. This is the Von Wiegand Show, infamous, rogue, legendary. We'll start the show. When I come back, we will have the famous author ready to go. Tonight, and we'll get, without any further ado, author Stephen Ubaney of the hit book Who Murdered Elvis. Welcome to the show, Stephen. How are you doing, sir?
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on your show.
Absolutely, man. We talked a few times, and it's a real pleasure. And your book is causing some riptides, and I love it. I can't wait to read it. And tell us about how you got started on all that in the book and where you want the conversation to go tonight, sir. The floor is yours.
Well, I'll tell you what, before I get into that, I wanted to tell you I got good news today that you're going to love. I got inducted into the Mayflower Society today. My ancestors.
Oh, my God. What an honor.
Yeah, so I'm now in
the folks what the Mayflower. Yes.
I'm now in the Sons of the American Revolution, and I just link back to the Mayflower. This is pretty exciting. So I listened to your monologue, and I thought everybody would like to know that. You know, kind of interesting.
I love that. Congratulations, sir. What an honor. That's great.
Yeah, it really is. I link back to John Howland, who was the guy who fell overboard and they rescued. And he was actually an indentured servant to John Carver. He had no money to come over here. He actually had to be indentured and work his way out of servitude and just to get to this country. So very interesting story that, you know, we'll talk about, I'm sure, on the phone at some point. So I just got that.
We definitely will.
I thought everyone would love to hear that. So food for conversation for another time.
That's very impressive. The Mayflower Society and the Sons of the Revolution are both very influential, and what an honor. So congratulations.
Yeah, thanks very much. They say less than 1% of American society can link back to the Mayflower, so that was just one of the lucky ones, I guess. Okay, I get asked all the time, you know, how do I write these books? I've got 4 books out now. I've got I'm writing the Who Murdered book series, and what I do is long after, decades and decades after, the case is closed, and everyone thought they found all the evidence on how these people died, and when everyone stops looking, I'm looking, and I get deathbed confessions and declassified documents, and I go back in, and I reopen these cases, and I run the suspects through motive, means, and opportunity, and which is the criminal process, when we used to have a criminal process, I tell you in the end of the book who murdered Elvis, and I'll tell you exactly who did it, and who murdered Diana, I'll tell you exactly who did it, who murdered FDR, I'll tell you exactly who did it. I have 4 volumes out. 2 of them are on Elvis. Volume 1 was on Elvis. Volume 2 was on FDR. A lot of people don't know that FDR did not die of the cerebral hemorrhage he had was caused by something else.
That's right.
And the next one was on Elvis, which is kind of the continuation of the first volume. And the one I have out right now is Who Murdered Diana, which is quite a story. So I get asked all the time, you know, what made you look at these people or this or that? And everybody has an obsession. I'm obsessed with history. I dig into it. I love it. You have to love it. If you don't love it, do something else. You know, some people hunt, some people fish, some people skydive. I do this. You know, Michelangelo didn't do the Sistine Chapel for money.
That's right.
You have to be inspired. You have to be inspired.
You had a passion.
That's exactly right. And you know, you look at, you know, the people like Carroll Shelby did the GT40. He was obsessed by speed. You know, I'm obsessed by this. So I've looked into all different cracks and crevices of history, and I never believe what I was told on a bunch of these subjects. And Elvis Presley is one of them. I mean, I grew up spinning the original 45s. I think by the time I was 11, I knew more about Elvis Presley than some of his relatives did. You know, unbelievable. So I never believed the story, but I call them Easter Bunny stories. These are Easter Bunny stories,
right?
You know, and we're reinvestigating history. We're pissed at Christopher Columbus, and we're reinvestigating all of this history except what really needs to be investigated, and no one's looking. So I'm looking. Okay. So,
love that.
Elvis Presley, I never, ever believed what they were told. The story kept changing. The medical examiner, Jerry T. Francisco, came out without one fingerprint being lifted from Graceland, without the toxicology reports coming back. He goes to and tells the waiting world Elvis died of cardiac arrhythmia, which is impossible to determine when you don't have a beating heart. You have to have a beating heart to determine if your heart is beating irregularly. He never examined Elvis's heart. So automatically you've got a problem. Elvis Presley underwent 2 head-to-toe physicals in the month before his death, one for Lloyd's of London and one for another insurance company. He passed both of them with flying colors. So the Easter Bunny story is starting to form. So, the drug thing, you know, the drug thing was unbelievable. What a fantasy. The story keeps changing. First it was his heart, and then it was drugs. The drug thing. 1979, ABC's 2020, Geraldo Rivera is trying to keep 2020 on the air. They're almost off the air because no one's watching it. And he decides to reinvestigate Elvis Presley, and he got a hold of Thompson and Cole, with their book, their investigative book into Elvis Presley, and they, Thompson and Cole, were Memphis natives, so they knew all the ins and outs. So, you know, they interview a bunch of people and this and that, and they do this display of showing all of these thousands and thousands of drugs and pills, and they dump them out for dramatic effect that were prescribed to Elvis Presley. And prescribed versus taking are two different things.
Okay. Right.
1976, Elvis Presley almost went bankrupt. And his father had seized possession of his finances to keep him solvent. And he was starting to make cutbacks. And at one point, it got so bad that the staff was told they were not to drink a bottle of water because it was too expensive.
Wow.
So instead of Elvis Presley hearing about these prescriptions for all of these other guys, you know, that Elvis was funding, he just told his doctor, just write all the prescriptions under my name. I don't want to hear about it from my dad. So all of these drugs were put in the middle of a room like a candy bowl, and everybody just had their hand in. And if there were a couple left, maybe Elvis would take them. Elvis Presley was, in 1968, Elvis Presley almost died from anaphylactic shock. He went to the dentist. They did some dental work. They gave him codeine. He had a very bad reaction to codeine. His throat started to swell closed. He would have died if his doctor wasn't on his toes. Dr. Nicopoulos saved Elvis Presley's life in 1968. So everyone knew after that date, keep codeine away from this guy. His doctors, his dentists, his nurses, everyone knew that this guy was allergic to codeine. So here's where I started to get a little suspicious as to what they said happened to Elvis Presley and was the foundation for my book and all of the investigation work that came afterwards. I ended up being friends with a man named Dan Warlick, who was the investigator for the medical examiner who dissected Elvis Presley's body and investigated the Graceland. We lost Dan a couple years ago now. We're losing a lot of these people now. He dissected Elvis Presley's voice box because they said that they thought he OD'd. Dissected the man's larynx, his voice box, took it out, looked at it. There were no signs of swelling. None. No anaphylaxis. So how is it that codeine shows up at 11 times the lethal level in one and only one of the three toxicology? If it's not in the body, it can't be in the toxicology report. And if you go that far, you've got a problem. So in
big
the
problem.
Case of Elvis Presley, there were three toxicology reports done on Elvis, one from the University of Tennessee. One was an independent lab in Memphis that they still had a name. And the third one was Bioscience Laboratories was in California. This is what the first two came up with. There are four types of drugs in Elvis Presley's body. Okay. And drugs come in different levels. Okay, there's trace, therapeutic, which is what a doctor would prescribe you, toxic, which will make you sick, and lethal. In the case of Elvis Presley, the first two toxicology reports came back between trace and therapeutic. They had to take his tissue samples and put them in little sealed containers, ship them off to Bioscience Laboratories in California, and all of a sudden we come up with codeine and all of these other drugs. We got a problem. So this is a serious problem when you try and get to the bottom of his death. So you have to ask yourself, what was going on with Elvis Presley, and why were all of these things happening?
Right.
I want to address Elvis Presley's physical condition before I get into his involvement in the mob and being stuck between the mob and the FBI, which gets most people killed. And it was no different here. Elvis is having some health problems. he was, his blood sugar was a little high. Elvis, which was discovered at the autopsy, and this is terrible to talk about, they do this thing at the autopsy called running the gut. And they take a flat-billed pair of surgical scissors, and they stretch out your colon, and they slice up your colon to see what's in there. In the case of Elvis Presley, he was jam-packed with clay-like matter that they couldn't even cut through. He hadn't had a bowel movement in almost a month.
Wow.
So this is why he had a twisted colon. It was a birth defect. It's very common. And you combine that with prescribing downers, and you have a constipation problem. This is why Elvis Presley looks so pasty and bloated in the last little while of his life. He had a medical problem
right.
with his intestines, and he was going to undergo surgery. He didn't live that long. So, you know, you've heard stories about him, you know, devouring 45 hamburgers and this and that. Of course, that's
right.
another Easter Bunny story. You know? So, very interesting of what's going on in here. Presley's manager is a very colorful figure, and I can't discuss the murder without discussing Colonel Parker. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Colonel Parker is a very, very interesting person. He wasn't a colonel, and his name wasn't Tom Parker. He's from the Netherlands, and his name was Andreas van Koo. That was his real name. He came from the Netherlands, and he stole away down a ship to America on, as close as they can figure it out by documents, May 19th, 1929. Very odd. He was working on the docks, in the shipping docks, to save up money to come to America. Well, on May 17th, 2 days before, a woman named Anna van de Eden was murdered. And he was a suspect in the murder. So he stowaways on a ship, comes to America, and goes into the Army immediately.
Hmm. Wow.
Goes into the Army, and he escapes, goes AWOL. They catch him, bring him back, put him in solitary confinement. He emerges with a mental illness, and when he's released, he takes the name of his commanding officer, Tom Parker. So here we have this psychopathic murdering stowaway wandering the streets of America who, he grew up working in carnivals, so this guy's a hell of a pitch man.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up working with animals and so forth, and he worked his way up in the carnivals to being a carnival barker. So he goes back to the trade that he knows. So he starts falling into
right.
managing acts. Minnie Pearl, Hank Snow,
mm-hmm.
Gene Austin, Roy Acuff, June Carter Cash, Johnny Cash's wife. Eventually ends up with Eddie Arnold. And Eddie Arnold had a tremendous problem with him, and it ended badly. So he's out there trying to get these, you know, the next best thing, the greatest thing. He's probably the greatest megalomaniac that ever existed, probably next to
right.
Brown. There's been a couple others, a couple in this country that I won't mention just because I'm going to be polite. So, but we'll have that discussion privately, I'm sure. So,
do tell, Stephen, do tell.
He comes to Elvis Presley. He sees this sensation, this kid who's just knocking him dead. He's got the new sound, he's got the look, and I mean, he's just turning the world upside down. So he starts to track Elvis, and he's trying to get close to him. Well, Elvis at that time was managed by Sun Records, and he approached Sun Records and bought him out. Sam Phillips, who won Sun Records, ran into some financial difficulties, and it was the best thing for him at the time to sign Elvis over. So Colonel Parker buys out the contract from Sun Records, and Elvis Presley now belongs to Colonel Parker. Sounds great.
Fascinating.
As soon as this happened, Eddie Arnold told Elvis, don't walk run from this guy. Run. He's no good. He will make side deals. He will exploit you. This guy's no good. But when Elvis was poor, he grew up poor. When you put your hand in your pocket and you feel nothing but your leg, you're going to listen to whoever's offering you money. And the colonel was offering great sums of money. So
that's right.
The colonel was plugging these stars in Las Vegas, and he met, you know, you don't play Vegas without meeting and being befriended by the mob back in the day. You're not
mm-hmm.
playing these hotel casino venues. You're just not. So a couple of the big players in the mob that ended up being friends with Colonel Parker was a fellow named Milton Prell. He was part of the Detroit syndicate, and he opened the Bingo Club in 1947, which later became the Sahara, and he opened it on Bookie and Racewater Mine, and he bought the Aladdin, and he eventually bought the Mint as well. Another one was Mo Dallas. These are all friends of Colonel Parker's, very steep in the mob. Mo Dallas, in the 1950s and 60s, he was Mr. Vegas. He was part
That's
of the
right.
Cleveland Syndicate. He ran the Stardust and the Desert Inn. And
wasn't he also in The Godfather?
Father,
they have portrayed
Mo
him
Dallas?
In The Godfather, too.
I believe mm-hmm. so, yeah. His real job was to be a close ally to Meyer Lansky and Jimmy Hoffa. So that's who was financing and befriending Frank Sinatra. And they all became neighbors of Colonel Parker in Palm Springs. So all of this backstory is going on. This is how, and back then, the mob ran the record companies, it ran the press agents, it ran the media, they ran everything. And I have to say this, and this may not be popular with some people, when the mob ran America, it was run better. They didn't.
I agree.
You know, they had better.
I totally agree with that statement.
Yeah. So you don't play Vegas without these people and being in contact with these people. So after befriending these people, Parker's military records and the facility that they were being held at suddenly burned down. Pretty interesting stuff. So here you have Elvis Presley being managed and supported by these people. And Elvis is, you know, he's a naive, he's a kid, and he's 20, 21 years old here, you know, and 56. Elvis Presley had just a rocket ride to fame that nobody ever saw before. And Sonny West told me this. I'm sorry. Yeah, Sonny West told me this story. He said, Elvis Presley was more famous than anybody who's ever been famous. And he said he talked to a woman one time. I mean, the fame that this guy had was incredible. He talked to a woman one time who was halfway around the world in a grass hut. They don't even have running water. They have a picture of Elvis Presley. I mean, you're dealing with a time. This was a time, man, when there was no, you didn't have the internet. You didn't have, it was a 64th of the communication that we had today. I mean, the fame that this guy had was absolutely unbelievable. So the mob is very present in Elvis Presley's life. They completely planned his wedding. They took Frank Sinatra's plane to Milton Prell's hotel to get married. Elvis Presley was in a velvet jail. They started to squeeze him. There are photos in my book of Mo Dallas actually funded G.I. Blues, which was the first film that Elvis did out of the coming out of the service. And there's a picture in my book of Mo Dallas and the whole crew standing there, and the only one in the whole picture that's not smiling is Elvis Presley. And there's reasons for that. They put this guy in situations that he simply did not want to be in. So, you fast forward, they're starting to squeeze him. It started out being a 25%. Colonel Parker was getting 25%. Well, Colonel Parker started to have his own partner. The mob became his partner. So now he hits mm-hmm. these Elvis for more money to cut them in. So there came a time where it was a 50-50 partnership. And, you know, Elvis was playing Vegas, doing 2-3 shows a night, you know, an hour and 15 minutes, 7 days a week. And he's making $125,000 a week. I mean, this is an enormous sum of money. And for at the time, a hell of a lot of money right now. But, I mean, back then it was a gargantuan sum of money. So he was basically in entertainment servitude. Couldn't go anywhere. Couldn't do anything. He was completely under Colonel Parker's thumb. And Colonel Parker had a big thumb because he was backed by big people. So while he's slaving away on stage, Colonel Parker is gambling at every casino in town. We all have our little idiosyncrasies, and Colonel Parker's was gambling. He was probably the greatest degenerate gambler in history. I mean, he was losing $1.5 million a night. Time,
oh my God.
His income in America was $5,800. I mean,
yeah.
this guy was really something. At the time of Elvis Presley's death, Colonel Parker's gambling debt was $32 million. And this is 1977.
Oh, my God.
So here we have
big
the mob
money back then. Big money.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
So here we have the mob squeezing Colonel Parker for the money that he's owed. Colonel Parker squeezing, you know, Elvis, who was his cash cow, for more and more money, and he's taking more and more of Elvis's money. So there's a big squeeze going on here. So Elvis sees this and he doesn't like it. He tries to break free. And one of his first times to rebel, I won't mention the guy's name. I know him, and he was in the room when this happened. It was during the movie years. There was, you know, a movie script is a lot of pages. And Elvis is reading these scripts, and they're cranking out a movie every 30 days. And it wasn't until I met Susanna Lee, who was his co-star on Paradise Hawaiian Style, that it was revealed to me that Elvis had body doubles who were surgically altered to look just like him. So she said the first couple of days she was on the set of Paradise Hawaiian Style, she's with a body double. Elvis is in the studio laying down tracks for the movie. She didn't even meet Elvis for the first week. So she told me that there's in the press kit of Paradise Hawaiian Style, she's got her arms around Elvis, and it's not Elvis. She said, you can clearly tell if you look, it's not Elvis. Elvis's face is very triangular. And this guy had a U face fit. He had thicker jowls. And this guy's name is Matt. And there was another guy's name. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but there was two of them. And these are the people that they're seeing when they claim that Elvis Presley is alive. These people are at the right age, and they're roaming around out there, and these are the people that are being spotted. Okay?
Right.
So, and the gambling and the mob involvement. The mob is starting to squeeze him, and Elvis has had enough of it. So in 1969, Elvis starts being threatened. There are letters being written to him that, you know, people are threatening him. They're going to kill him on stage, to the point where Elvis was appearing on stage with a gun strapped on his ankle. And, of course, when you have bell bottoms, it does a wonderful job of hiding this. So in 1973, for example, it got so bad. This started in 1969. This got so bad, he went to meet Nixon in 1970. December 21st of 1970, Elvis Presley meets Nixon, and he wants to get federal credentials so he and his group can carry guns in every state wherever they fly and wherever they go, because the threats are getting ridiculous. So he gets his federal credential, and he's starting to gain traction against the mob. He becomes a black belt. Everyone around him becomes a black belt. He would stand at Sonny West's wedding with three guns on him. Everywhere Elvis went, he had at least two guns on him. because he knows that somebody's trying to take him out, and he has suspicions as to mm-hmm. what. So Elvis Presley knew that there was bad blood around him, and there was a wrestling match for possession of his soul with what he was doing and wanted to do and the mob undertone of what's going on. So it got so bad that the Washington Post on January 27th of 1972 ran an article, and it's, of course it's in my book, that Elvis got federal credentials. Well, this drove the mob crazy. This wasn't supposed to come out. This was supposed to stay secret. Someone leaked the story to the Washington Post, and they printed it. And the article's in my book. And I'll tell everybody where to get the book in a second. It's available on ebook and audiobook all the way around the world. It's available on Amazon all the way around the world. But I'll tell you what, it's cheaper on my website. So get a piece of paper and a pencil, and I'll give you my website name just in just a little bit. Okay, I want you to be ready for it. Okay, so right after Aloha from Hawaii, February 18th, 1973, he's on stage in Las Vegas. Four men rush the stage, and they're coming after Elvis. And his bodyguards were behind the curtains, as they always were, and they took three of the guys out. The fourth one made it to Elvis, and Elvis showed him very quickly why he was a black belt. I mean, this is not fantasy land. There's a lot that
right.
is held within Elvis's inner circle. It has just now come out. It's almost been 45 years this guy's been gone. So why
Incredible.
They needed to, and I, you know, I thought I was the only one that knew Elvis Presley was murdered. Come to find out, there were other people who knew. Elvis Presley's father, Vernon Presley, knew immediately. And the first words out of his mouth was, oh, my God, they murdered my son. So I'll come today in a second and why that ties in. So Vernon Presley was so convinced that his son was murdered, he hired two private investigators to find the murderer. Sadly, Vernon died 2 years after Elvis, and my book actually picks up where his probe left off. Susanna Lee, I just mentioned her. She was Elvis's co-star in Paradise Hawaiian Style. I love Susanna Lee. We lost her a couple years ago. She had an epic battle with liver cancer that she finally lost, which is horribly sad. She was a sweetheart.
Yeah.
She made the mistake
yeah.
of going on television 6 months after Elvis died. She lived in Memphis. They were good buddies. She went on television and made the mistake of saying, when are we going to solve the murder of Elvis Presley? Did this woman.
Wow.
It was truly incredible. They clipped her brake lines. They jumped the wall to get into her house, and she had like seven dogs. They killed all of her dogs. They burned her house down. The harassment that this woman put up with was truly incredible. Remember, she finally had to leave Tennessee. She finally had to go to Florida, which, of course, she was until her death. Dr. Nicopoulos, of course, Dr. Nick, as Elvis called him, as everybody in the group called him. Dr. Nick was a nice man, and he truly cared about Elvis. He did the very best he could to look after him. So if you go to my website, whomurderedbooks.com, I'll say it three times because people like things in three.
Right.
Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Got to.
You know.
Got to. I've been there. It's a great website.
Yeah, there's a video on there of Dr. Nick saying Elvis Presley was murdered, and he's naming the murderer, but they've got it bleeped out for legal reasons. This is not something that has just been contrived in my book. People have been talking about this for over 40 years. So Dick Grob is another one. He was Elvis's chief of security. He wrote a book entitled The Elvis Conspiracy. There's
mm-hmm.
a lot of people on the inside. And I ended up knowing most of the Memphis Mafia, not all. And they're almost all gone now. And publicly, they'd never say it. Privately, almost all of them knew it. They knew something was going on. So this is really quite a story. So Elvis sticks himself between the mob and the FBI, and he ends up paying the price for it. When he gets his badge from Nixon, Nixon asks him to do something for him. Elvis was a huge patriot. He really, really was a great dude. I mean, everybody would have loved this guy. And I'll tell you a story about Cadillacs here in a second. Richard Nixon asked Elvis Presley to hide FBI agents in his band, pose them as band members, when he played through his contract 2 months a year in Las Vegas. Their job was to investigate the mob. And if we, you know, I mean, the movie Casino is fictitious, but you get the idea of how steeped in the 1970s mob, you know, Vegas was.
Oh, sure.
So this was Elvis's job, and they were all caught. And Elvis died mysteriously a little while before he was supposed to turn state evidence against the mob, him and others. You know, so there's a huge backstory about this. And I didn't know that. That was not, I'd love to be able to take credit for that, but there was a lot of research done before I came along and put the capstone on this and did my investigation. In 1990, there was a woman named Maria Columbus who blew the lid off that story. She was walking through Graceland and she was going in the trophy room, and she saw on the wall that the State Department wrote a letter to Elvis Presley thanking him for his cooperation or something. Well, she got a hold of them, and she wanted to know what that letter was for. They got back to her and told her the story. You can't get any more firsthand information than coming from the government themselves.
Right. Amazing.
So, you know, there's an awful lot going on here that people probably don't know. Are we straight up, or do we have to stop for commercial breaks? I don't want to run past.
No, we are. I have waived some of those. Unless you want a break, we can. I've always got things that I can play for promos, but if you want a break to get some water, that's fine, or we can keep on going. I'm wide open.
Man, I can do this all night.
Floor is yours.
You were on a tape before.
Let's talk, then. Let's keep on going. That's my style.
Okay,
I mean, when I give people the floor, I'm serious. This is fast. I love this theme, this genre, this era in American folklore is fascinating to me. The late 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s was where it all went down. The mafia in Vegas was squeezing Colonel Parker and Elvis, and that's a fascinating backstory to what kind of set him up, right, for his ultimate demise.
It was a horrible situation. It really was. And, of course, the mob and the FBI leaked like a sieve back then. So the same people who were gathering information on the mob started gathering on Elvis at some point. And this is, why do you think there were bars on Graceland? They took them down.
That's
now.
Right.
So look, there were bars on Graceland. Look at Graceland. Look at Michael Corleone's house in Godfather 2. And you show me the parallels.
Exactly. I've always thought that they look very similar.
Yeah, you have gates. You have walls. You have armed guards. You have closed circuit television cameras. There are bars on the windows. You don't think he knew that people were coming after him, do you? Colonel Parker did the same thing in his house. Colonel Parker also took it one step further, and he went alarm crazy. He put four or five different alarms on his property. You know, these people knew something was coming. They knew something was coming. So Elvis was involved. There's no better way to say it. He pissed the mob off, something fierce. But he did it one way, and he also did it another way. Because he went bankrupt, it was close to going bankrupt in 1976, he was trying to sell one of his planes. And it was a smaller plane, and it was called the Hound Dog 2. And Elvis had moved on to the bigger plane, which was the Lisa Marie. And the other plane was dry docked. And it was almost a $900,000 plane, and it was just sitting there doing nothing. So Vernon said, Elvis's father said, well, look, let's sell this off. Let's bankroll the money, and we'll start to be solvent again. Sounds like a great idea. Well, what happened was he lists the plane for sale. He gets contacted by a fellow that I'm not going to mention his name because I just don't think it's necessary. But he was an international mob figure that they've been watching for 4 or 5 years. Contacts Vernon Presley, Elvis's father, and says, "Look, I'll rig you up a deal where I'll pay more for the plane than you paid originally, and I'll arrange it so I get the plane, you get more money. What do you think?" And he said, "Well, yeah, sounds like a great deal." So he told Vernon, remortgage the plane, bring it up to code, do a bunch of renovations to it. I'll take the plane, and then I'll make payments back to you. And the end result, you'll get more money for the plane. The plane will be sold, and I'll get a better plane. Well, the plane disappeared, and not one check came in. So
right.
Now Elvis is involved with the FBI on the back channel. Now this is so you have these two FBI stories and mob stories going on simultaneously in the background. And, of course, you know, with the Memphis Mafia, the group that surrounded Elvis, nothing got out from Elvis to the media, so no one knew this. They didn't have Facebook. There was no Twitter. And nothing got into Elvis unless it was censored. So because they had all of these secrets that were being held, you know, we had this, it's never enough, our fascination with Elvis Presley and what was really going on. And it's finally starting to leak out. And it just continues to be more and more fascinating. What an incredibly dichotomy of this individual and how dynamic he really was. And I'll get to that in a second. Elvis Presley started canceling tours. He started to rebel. I never finished the story about the script and rebellion. I'm sorry. I have to get back to that story. Elvis
yeah,
gets
we
got to
hear
script.
About that.
Elvis gets the new script for the new movie. And he's flipping through this thing, and it's hundreds of pages. I won't mention the name of the guy who was in the room. I know him, but I won't do that. I don't like to name names unless they've murdered someone, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Fair is fair, right?
He's flipping through this script, and he's furious. He said, you know, the last movie I was a speedboat racer. The one before that I was a race car driver. This one is on a motorcycle. It's the same script. And he takes it and he throws it up in the air. Hundreds of pages go all over the place. It must have been a hell of a mess for somebody to pick up because Elvis wasn't picking up. So the next morning he doesn't go. Doesn't show up for filming. And what happened was, Colonel Parker came up, the studio came up, the producers came up for the film, RCA, I believe, sent a representative up, and they sat Elvis down with Colonel Parker, and they had a talk with him, and they said flat out, you're going to do these movies our way, or you're not going to do anything else. And it was at that point that Colonel Parker raised his percentage of Elvis's management. And I won't mention the man's name who's in the room. Elvis turned white. They had a little private conversation after the other people were in the room when he was confronted. Afterwards, the men had a private conversation, and Elvis comes back in, and he's white, white as a ghost. And it was made very clear to Elvis that they weren't threatening his career. They were threatening his
right.
life. You're going to do
That's right.
what we say. And it's a very scary, scary situation. When you're the biggest trick and shoe leather, and you're starting to be taken over by the mob. So this is why Elvis rebelled, went into got the federal narcotics badge, and got all of these things. So Elvis started to cancel tours. He started to have health issues. You know, as a doctor, and I know many of them, what you prescribe has a great effect on people.
Mm-hmm.
if I was a doctor and I was to prescribe uppers, it would give someone diarrhea. If I was to prescribe downers, it would make people constipated. So if you prescribe downers to somebody who has a twisted colon and has all kinds of digestive issues, you're going to create a problem. So Elvis was in the middle of canceling tours. He had all kinds of problems with his digestion and his digestive tract. And to the point it got so bad, they were fighting so bad between Elvis and the Colonel. Colonel Parker tried to sell his contract. And there was an article that ran in the Nashville Banner, and Elvis almost got sold like a commodity. It came very, very close. Parker could no longer put money in his pockets because his cash cow was rebelling. So if he can't get any more money, the mob's going to squeeze in for the gambling debts. And this is a hell of a mess. It's really a mess.
Right.
So, you know, and Colonel Parker did a very intelligent. This guy was incredibly smart. He in 1974, he started what's called Boxcar Enterprises, which was basically, and Elvis got a chunk of it, but like most of the deals, it was grossly unfair to Elvis. Boxcar Enterprises basically was the precursor to Elvis Presley Enterprises in the sense that a deal was struck that they could sell Elvis's image and likeness and posters and things like that. And slowly, the positioning was happening. They didn't need Elvis alive to make money anymore. So there was an awful lot going on. And you have to ask yourself, 1977, August 16th, I knew exactly where I was. I'm that old. How did they have all of the T-shirts pressed? How did they have all of the records already pressed and ready to go? How did all of that happen?
Because I always wondered about that, Stephen, as a kid. I always thought, man, this is like merchandising ready to go at the press of a button. And I always suspected foul play with Elvis's death. I mean, I'm a person like yourself. I rarely believe what I hear on the media or what I read. I always challenge it and always don't always believe the official narratives, you know.
Well, I call it the
But that is strange.
I call it the official fiction. George Carlin said it best. If truth was suddenly introduced into American society, the whole system would collapse.
That's right.
And in
Love
the case
George
of
Carlin.
Elvis Presley, you know, it's there was a lot going on. 1977, Elvis is rebelling. He's no longer turning money like he used to. And Colonel Parker's having a fit. Because the mob's going to can't squeeze him if he can't squeeze Elvis, and Elvis isn't going to be squeezed. So at this time, you know, in March of 1977, Elvis Presley is in Hawaii, and he's on vacation with a handful of friends, and he's reorganizing his life. He had fired three bodyguards, trimming his payroll. More firings were coming because he didn't trust some of the people who were in his inner circle. It is unfortunate that he fired three of the bodyguards who were probably the most trusted bodyguards that he had. And there were phone conversations that were recorded between them, and Elvis was planning on taking them back. His father did it because his father was in charge of his finances, and Elvis wasn't thrilled about it. So he was just basically saying, look, sit tight, let me reorganize some things, and I'll bring you guys back. Didn't happen. So there were more firings coming. He didn't trust the people around him. Joe Esposito. Joe Esposito was one of Elvis Presley's road manager. Joe Esposito was Colonel Parker's mole. He bled back to Colonel Parker everything that Elvis was doing. So here they are. Joe Esposito is in March 77. He's in Hawaii with Elvis. And Elvis starts talking about firing the colonel. That got back to the colonel in about 3 seconds. He had recently written people out of his will, making Lisa Marie the sole person in charge of everything. and that didn't set well. Elvis is in the middle of breaking up with his present girlfriend, which I won't name, and he was seeing another one. He was starting to see someone else who, after he was murdered, she was also murdered. It's also in my book. You can't make this up, folks. Bad blood between
Wow.
Joe Esposito. Joe Esposito wanted to... They all loved racquetball. Elvis Presley hit a racquetball court behind his house. I've been there. It's kind of neat. And it's, you know, I'll tell you what, go to Graceland. You know, I go to Graceland and bow to the master, because before anybody did anything, Elvis Presley did everything. There'll never be another one. And I know Graceland is getting dwarfed by time. You know, the time marches on monetarily, but you have to go and really, really absorb this incredible human being. So they were, Joe Esposito wanted to start a racquetball court franchise, and he wanted to use Elvis Presley's name. Elvis said, sure, go ahead. Colonel Parker had a fit because he wasn't getting a cut out of using Elvis's name. So Joe Esposito was involved in a lawsuit at the time of Elvis Presley's death with Elvis. All of these suspects are listed in my book, and I run them all through motive, means, and opportunity. And this is how I come up with, of course, the who murdered him. The name of the book is Who Murdered Elvis, and I'll tell you exactly who did it. 1976, Elvis Presley was very, very fascinated with the JFK assassination. In the House Select Committee on Assassination, they had my friend Mark Lane started the governmental, you know, they were reopening the assassination of JFK, and I believe Martin Luther King. And Elvis Presley was involved with a deal with William Sullivan, who was in the FBI, and he was going to finance an investigation into the JFK assassination. And by the time Elvis Presley died, in 1977, both William Sullivan and Elvis Presley were both dead. This guy pissed off so many high-profile people. And it's a shame because he was just about the nicest guy you could ever possibly meet. And I'll get to that in a second. So I already said Elvis died mysteriously before he was going to turn state's evidence against the mob for the airplane thing and other things. And his death scene, the whole manner in which the death scene happened was very suspicious. And all of these deaths have, I call them threads of, in the Diana book, I kind of do a little summary of all these things, and I call them threads of insanity, because there are little threads that go between all of these murders that people need to start looking at. And I say in the book, to look at Elvis Presley's murder as a singular thing is to look at a blade of grass in a lawn, because this has happened all over the place. So,
right.
They come to Elvis Presley's death scene, okay, and they take Elvis out. It must have been a horrific scene. And they take him to the hospital, and the two EMTs who were there, I mean, the place is a mess. There was evidence of a struggle. I mean, it was a hell of a mess. So the two EMTs come back after the first thing they do when they get Elvis Presley in there is in the hospital is they rinse his stomach contents down the drain. Well, that's a little convenient. So it's kind of hard to have a real autopsy when you do that. So
right.
Come back. Now you have the medical examiner's investigator, Dan Warlick, not knowing very well, and he came back with the district attorney and Lieutenant McCochran, who was part of the police force, and they're going through the upstairs at Graceland. Everything's been sanitized. The bed's been made. Everything has been clean. The EMTs were there just ahead of Dan Warlick, and they were coming down. They walk in, and they're astonished. All of their resuscitation equipment has been neatly piled in the corner. That's not how they left this.
Hmm.
So they're coming down the stairs as Warlick and McCochran and the district attorney are coming up the stairs, and they meet them halfway, and they say, this place has been completely sanitized, which is kind of interesting since the police department had the place on lockdown. Nobody knows who gave the order to sanitize this.
Huh.
So they go up there, and they're looking around trying to find clues, and Dan Warlick, the investigator, blows his stack because he realizes this place has been completely sanitized. So they also started pointing
out
evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had the sanitized death scene, just like JFK. His brain's blowing out. They take him into Parkland Memorial. Secret Service is out with bucket and a sponge, and they're cleaning the blood splatter out of the limousine. Same thing with Marilyn Monroe. When the investigators come to check everything out, Marilyn Monroe's housekeeper is doing the laundry of the death scene. Princess Diana, she just gets declared dead. They call in special equipment to sanitize the tunnel, and they reopen it. Pretty hard. You know, you only get one chance to investigate a crime. That's why they make crime scene tape, you know.
Kind
it's
of
like
a common theme there, you know? Yeah, it's a common theme among these murders.
Absolutely. And I laid that out in Who Murdered Diana, which, I don't know, did I send you that one? Or did I send you the other one?
Yes, that's the one that I got.
Okay. Yeah, so you can see how I put things together. And again, all of these things, they introduce phony evidence to spin you away from doing a real investigation. In Elvis Presley's case, there are drug syringes that are up there. But they're not the type of drug syringe. They're like a caulking gun where you can – there was no needle in them. They're like skeleton type where you would put a cylinder full of – vitamin D in there, B12 or something like that. And, you know, it's not a syringe that you would see. It was a cartridge type of syringe. So there was no needle in them. So that they couldn't figure out, well, what the hell are these two drug syringes doing up here? What is going on here? Dan Warlick goes back, reports all of this information to Jerry T. Francisco, the medical examiner, who is completely disinterested in this. And he goes to the waiting world without, like I said, without a fingerprint being lifted from Graceland, without the toxicology report coming back, and he tells a Grimm's fairy tale that it's just the most incredible thing I've ever seen. In fact, the other people who were involved in the autopsy almost fell over backwards when he came out with what he said. So Dan Warlick is now trying to cut into Elvis Presley's body and examine the body. And I know this is terrible to talk about. He takes a magnifying glass, and he had the same magnifying glass. He showed it to me. He had it in his desk. He kept it. And he looked over every inch of Elvis Presley's body. There was not one needle mark in Elvis's body, not one. What in the hell were those drug syringes doing there? And I answer all of these questions in the book, and I'll tell you what, you know, we're 21 years into the 21st century, and you can still get a Christmas present for around $20. Go to my website and pick up a book. Somebody on your Christmas list is going to love my work. If not Elvis, they'll love FDR, they'll love the Diana books. There are very few people like me who are out there digging and telling the truth. And I'll tell you what, authors don't live on a big hill in a big house. Those days are long, long gone. You know, if you support my efforts and you support what I'm doing, go buy a book. You'll love it. Someone will love your books, my books on your Christmas list. So,
I agree. Absolutely. And tell the audience your website again and where to get the book.
Go to whomurderedbooks.com, and I'll even autograph it for you. I'm not the one that fulfills them, but I can autograph them for you. And just leave a little note. If it's a Christmas present for somebody and it's a Christmas present for Susie, just put the note in there, you know, to Susie on Christmas, and I'll do my best to autograph it for them. So now if you live in another country, It's on Amazon, so you can get the physical book printed in your language. It's on Amazon. It's also an ebook, an audiobook, all the way around the world. And I want everyone to know this, because this needs to stop. Another thing that needs to stop is this Elvis is alive thing. They are uncovering evidence that Elvis Presley is alive. And I've talked to many people who are in this camp, and they are finding evidence. But what they don't seem to understand is that the evidence that they're finding has been planted there for them to find. Because the more time we spend looking for a live Elvis Presley at McDonald's, the less time we spend solving this murder. Why do you think
That's
they don't
right.
want you upstairs? Sure. Why do you think they don't want you upstairs at Graceland? It's a crime scene, folks. Might have a little something to do with it.
They love to distract the American people, absolutely.
You know, small, shiny objects. You know.
Right. By the way, you mentioned the point, Stephen, we have listeners, sorry to interject here, all over the world. So, yeah, folks, if you're in the UK, we have listeners in Ireland and elsewhere, in France and Germany and, you know, Amsterdam, et cetera, because I see their ISP on my studio board. They're listening now. Go to Amazon.com to get the book, or WhoMurderedBooks.com to get the litany of all the Stephen, his fantastic books on Who Murdered Elvis, Who Murdered FDR, Who Murdered Diana. And you mentioned a fourth book, too. Are you working on a new one for us?
There are two on Elvis, Volume 1 and Volume 2
okay.
on Elvis. And
gotcha.
Somebody just passed me a note. The printed books for Elvis are not on Amazon, but ebook and audiobook
okay.
and Kindle are. So,
fantastic.
How much time do we have? Are we near
We have all the time that we need. No, we are good to go, sir. I can always go into overtime, which I normally do, by the way, on every show. So we have plenty of time. I had kind of prepped the audience last week, just so you know that you were coming on, and I said, we're going to hold back your calls, folks, towards the end, but we got to get out this intel. This is amazing material. Can't wait to read your books, all of them.
Thank you. And there are other people who have investigated this. I'd love to beat my chest and say, you know, I'm the be-all and end-all, and I did all this investigative work. Not true. There were 30 years of work that other people have done and investigated before I got here. I just finished it and made it make sense. Okay. As far as Elvis and OD, there was another rumor that he said that he OD'd. This is all falder up. Elvis Presley was a veteran pill popper. His doctor, after Elvis almost died in 1968 from the codeine pen, he asked his doctor for the physician's desk reference so he could look up what pill was what interacted with what not to take with what. Elvis was very, very smart. He was an avid reader. This is no dumb guy. He knew.
Right.
You show him a pill, he'll tell you exactly what it was and who makes it and where it came from. There's no way this guy was just some blubbering goofball who just took the wrong pills. Not happening. This guy knew exactly what he was doing. And, you know, the stories that get twisted around. Heart attack. This is another one. At the autopsy, there were a bunch of doctors at the autopsy. At the autopsy, there was one man there named Noel Florendo. His job, he was at the autopsy because he specialized in operating this microscope. What they did, and this is an awful thing to talk about. Boy, I just shiver when I talk about this. I'm this huge Elvis Presley fan. I'm the last person who wanted to write
Me
a book
too.
Like this. But
mm-hmm.
I really, really had to let people know how badly they're being lied to. So they take Elvis Presley's vital organs out. And this is in detail in the book. And they take his heart, and there's a medical instrument, I can't remember its name, and what it does is it slices your organ every 16th of an inch. And that's what they did with Elvis's heart. They sliced it every 16th of an inch, and they took every single piece of slide of this organ and put it under the microscope, every 16th of an inch. And they were looking for blockages or clots or something, anything. There was no gross evidence of a heart attack, none. Elvis is 42. He was years away from having any sort of heart problem. So when you take into account all of the evidence, Elvis Presley was murdered, and the cover-up was incredible. There were two death certificates filed for Elvis Presley, and they contradicted each other. I mean, it's just the cover-up is incredible. The cover-up
is
incredible.
Stephen, I've got a quick question for you. What exactly was the official cause of death on each of those death certificates?
One was cardiac arrhythmia. Well, one was cardiac arrhythmia, and the other one was, late here on the East Coast, and you know what? I'm not going to come up with
it. I hear you. I'm sorry. I know it's 3 hours ahead, and being a night show like Coast to Coast. And by the way, folks, the author was on Coast to Coast a few weeks back. I was riveted. And we have no problem talking about one of our favorite shows on this show. I've always been a big Art Bell fan, and you were talking to George Norrie, and it was a great interview and conversation. And I thought, this is the kind of material that I went for the Von Wiehent show. And this is right up our alley, politics, pop culture, international and domestic intrigue, the mafia, any kind of a sensational story, and real history and the real research that you've done, the real truth that you've uncovered. A lot of people would say, oh, this is just Elvis is alive. No, Elvis is not alive. Elvis was murdered. And that is the great distinction of my show. We're not telling you Elvis is alive. We're telling you he was murdered by very important, powerful people who were on the nefarious side of the law. And I can't wait to get into your book and find out where you name the names and the times and the dates. And, you know, how would you describe the actual murder kit of Elvis Presley?
Well, that's something I think I'm going to save for the book. I have to pull something back.
Okay. Can you give us a teaser?
It was just one little snippet. It was an inside job. They had help.
Okay.
There were people.
That's all I need to know.
Yeah, there were people around Elvis who weren't necessarily happy with him.
Gotcha.
I'll save the rest of that for the book.
Right.
Elvis is alive. I've got to get back to Elvis is alive because I know some of these people. Nice people. And we've had this discussion. There's nothing Elvis Presley loved on this planet more than Lisa Marie, his daughter. Nothing, bar none. Do you think Elvis would have sat by and watched her suffer through everything that she's been through and not stepped in to help? The struggle that this girl has have been gargantuan. If Elvis Presley was on this planet, there's no way he would not have stepped in to help her. So, I mean, it's sad that people are still spinning that. And it's also kind of interesting that as soon as Colonel Parker died, so did the Elvis sightings go away. It was good for record sales.
Mm-hmm.
So,
interesting. I love how you tie everything together, Stephen. I just love how you tie all the dots. You dot all the I's, cross all the T's, and you, the interchange of all the thoughts and ideas and all the intel that you bring to the table. I love how you tie it all together for us. Amazing.
Well, when you're telling the truth, it's pretty easy to do.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. That's why we love the truth on my show.
Yeah, this started out for me as just bedtime reading. I never had a book in mind. And I got further into it and further into it. Next thing you know, I'm reading like 12, 13 books. And then I went down to meet the the guy who was at the autopsy, and then I started meeting other people. Dan Warlick, who was at the autopsy, who's gone now. Wow, they're all leaving us, which is really terrible. I think I'm the only one on the planet who knows everything that they had to say. Dan Warlick was an attorney, and he represented Dr. Nikopoulos, Elvis's doctor. So when I contacted Dan, and I went down to see him, nice man, very nice man, who did not believe that Elvis was murdered until about the last month of his life. He didn't understand that he only saw what was going on the autopsy table. He didn't understand the backstory of everything that happened. Once he understood all of that, he started to come around. So once he realized that I was not half crazed and that I had a genuine interest in really getting to the bottom of all of this, he turned me into meeting Elvis's doctor, Dr. Nikopoulos. And he's got to be the most maligned person in human history. Everybody has to blame somebody. And when you have a godlike figure like Elvis Presley, and you have this horrible tragedy, someone's got to take the fall. And it ended up, it was Dr. Nikopoulos. And he lived with that the whole rest of his life. Dr. Nikopoulos, actually, about 3 weeks after Elvis died, was at a football game. And I can't remember who he was there with. He told me the story. And I can't remember who he was there with, but it's immaterial. It's a micro fact. The macro fact is that he was shot in the chest with a bullet, but the bullet had run out of gas, and it just cut him in the chest, and it fell down on the bleachers in front of him.
Weird.
This happened shortly after Elvis Presley died. I mean, this is incredible. I mean, you can't make this up. And I said, Doc, you've got to
No,
be
you
kidding.
Can't.
He said, no, I wish I was kidding you. He said, I'm not. He said, I don't know how he was alive. But, you know, it's just kind of crazy stuff. More parallel.
It is.
To
hey, Stephen. If I could interject here and ask you a quick question. Let's get back to that story, if you don't mind, a little bit back where Elvis is on the stage and they rushed the stage. In your book, do you name the names of that assailant?
I do not.
Okay.
I do not, because it was
second. Was that guy a mafioso, or do you think he was, you know, a government assassin or just a rogue assassin, or what do you think? What's your take on that?
I don't know how to answer that question. I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I try not to.
It's kind
make
of a wild story.
Yeah, there are 45 factual sources in my book that go back to government documents or firsthand accounts. That one I couldn't nail down to a firsthand account, so I didn't touch it. My guess.
Right, and I remember hearing about that back in the day, and I knew that Elvis was a black belt, and I knew he had, you know, the pistol on his ankle. Good for him. I love guns too, so. He was smart to protect himself, and I always knew that there was a backstory as a kid, you know, when Elvis met President Nixon. I thought, why is this entertainer meeting the president? There's got to be more to the story than he's a patriot, and there was. Amazing
stuff.
Yeah,
there really was. And it's just amazing. You look at the parallels of these other famous people who got between the mob and the FBI and the Planet Evidence. I mean, all of these things, and I lay that out quite well in the Diana book. I call them threads of insanity because they all are. You can take a look right through history. But it takes some lunatic like me to put all this together, you know.
Right. I love that. Threads of insanity. So true.
Yeah, the empty drug syringes at Elvis Presley, the upstairs of Graceland, were planted just to spin people's mind away. In the same way that the pristine bullet was found on one of the stretchers in the JFK assassination.
Right.
And
as a kid, I was fascinated by the JFK assassination. Just, I used to read books on that, and, like, I was going to catch the bad guys. That was my thought process. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to catch them. And so I love these stories because it's real truth in real America, you know?
The Dr. Nicopoulos was set up in the toxic media in the same way that Oswald was set up in the toxic media. They were both found guilty in the court of public opinion. I said, these things kind of regurgitate themselves. You know, Elvis Presley, the condition of his body was the same as Sonny Liston and, you know, nude from the waist down. And this is what the mob does to embarrass tough guys. Benito Mussolini, same thing. This is what the mob does to embarrass tough guys. Elvis was never on the toilet. He was never on the toilet. It would have been futile. There's no way he was going to pass anything into his intestines. He was never on the toilet. And people say, well, he didn't look like Elvis in the casket. Well, he was tackled from behind, and they drove his face into the ground. That's why he didn't look like Elvis. You know, his nose looked different. They had passed his nose. You know, they got him from behind. This was quite a setup. So the only other person I know who started to investigate things to the level that I did is a guy named Jared Parker. He had purchased at auction letters that Elvis had written to, I don't know, someone, saying that he was being threatened and that his wife was in danger. And Jared Parker purchased these, and they were having the first annual Elvis convention. He was supposed to be a keynote speaker. And he was going to tell, there were thousands of people, he was going to tell the crowd this. And he was murdered on the way to the auditorium. And it's on the back of my book. You know, they murdered this guy, and his picture is on the back of my book. You know, so this is still going on. You can't make this up, guys. You just can't. You know?
Yeah, it is. I think if Americans, even if they really knew, well, I'll back up. We think we know our country, folks. We think we know the sanitized history that we've been given, the lies, in other words. We believe a lot of it, and we think a lot of it is true, and a lot of it is not true. But I think if Americans truly knew the truth of this nation, where it's at today, what has happened between, you know, various mafiosos, government agencies. We know the tip of the iceberg. I think it would blow people's minds, Stephen. I think they would just be in shock. One book I'd like you – well, I'll tell you a book that I'm an author too. I wrote The Bachelor's Guide to the Galaxy. That's more of a fun book. But I love a good mystery. And a book that I'd like to write, that maybe you should write because you're probably better at it than me, is a book on, I would say, Who Murdered Las Vegas? The Mandalay Bay Massacre. Now, that is a storyline that I mentioned in the monologue, and I have on my Gab account. A lot of photographs from people have surfaced. And, of course, it kind of ties in a weird sense because Elvis Presley – you know, he did a lot of acts in Vegas. He was there for years at the Hilton International there off the strip. I've been there. And a lot of strange things happen in Las Vegas. I love that town. It's full of intrigue, but that's another weird story. But that's for a different day, a different show. But I think that would be a good one for you.
I lived in Las Vegas in the late 90s. As a matter of fact, I was living in Vegas when Diana was killed.
Wow.
And I wouldn't touch that subject with 25 10-foot poles.
I know.
I was one of the first people who was asked, and a lot of people don't know this. I'm glad, I don't know if I should say this or not. Okay, I can say it without saying the name. I was one of the first people asked, probably the first person asked, to investigate the Jeffrey Epstein thing.
Right.
And I said, how many no's do you want? No, 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 hell no, not even touching it, not even going close to it.
I don't blame you.
I only talk about people who have been dead for decades.
Smart. A lot safer that way. I totally agree. That's why I mentioned on the show the four-year anniversary of the Mandalay Bay massacre was, you know, last a month, October 1st, 2017, that went down. And they really buried that story. And they put out that stupid Paddock guy and another Patsy. But it kind of is similar to these threads of insanity you were talking about. They put out these lies, these big events happen. Elvis dying was a huge event. I remember being a kid seeing the tabloids, you know, Elvis Presley died, plastered everywhere. I remember women crying in the supermarket. I first heard about that at the grocery store there with my parents. And I remember the news came out over some AM radio. That's why I love AM radio, because they're always putting out the wire feed. And people were just going nuts. I mean, grown men shocked. I remember women just, I mean, the millions of fans, deep fans that Elvis had, to this day, it's amazing. But I bet Elvis Presley Enterprises is bigger today than it was back then.
That's entirely possible. I remember where I was when you had these things in your life that are etched in your brain. You'll never forget them, where you were when 9/11 happened. I know exactly where I was when Elvis Presley died. And my mother about collapsed. You know, I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, I wasn't alive for the Kennedy assassination. I don't know what that was like. This was huge. I mean, the world, the world, not just America, the world gasped. You know, it was just incredible. I mean, it was like the Princess Diana murder times 50, the shock and everything that we were going through. I mean, it's something I've never seen before, and I hope the hell I never, ever see anything like it again. It was...
Yeah, and the world mourned. I mean, the world mourned Elvis. And I can remember heads of state. You know, this is pre-CNN, folks. I'm dating myself here, but, you know, and Stephen is too. But the heads of state of governments were honoring Elvis Presley and seeing and coming on the telly, as the British would say, talking about him. I think Graceland for a year or two just had so many flowers and offerings, they couldn't keep up with truckloads, I heard, would show up with candy boxes and cards, letters, telegrams from all over the world. I mean, the outpouring of love for this guy, the people that he, you know, if God sends you down here and says, I want you to reach people, boy, did Elvis reach people on so many continents, in so many countries and on so many levels, man. It's amazing.
Well, there's a reason for that. Elvis, how do I put this properly? Elvis was such a part of Americana because we grew up together. He grew up with television. 1955, 1966, television was coming about. Television grew up with Elvis Presley. Prior to that, your radio was a piece of furniture in the living room, and you were just listening to whatever your parents listened to. Well, Elvis came about with portable record players. So for the first time, kids had their own music, and they could take it everywhere they wanted. So it was, you know, I mean, we really, before Elvis, I mean, we were listening to, you know, Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree. You know, and here comes
That's
this
right.
kid. Here comes
Maybe
this
some
kid.
Jazz. Yeah, stuff like that, right. Frank Sinatra. Yeah.
Somebody needed to be first, and Elvis changed the world. There were no black artists. There was no Motown. There was no Michael Jackson, Jackson 5. There was no British Invasion. There was none of that. John Lennon said it best. Before Elvis, there was nothing. And the Beatles always said that they always felt sorry for Elvis because there was four of them. And when they wanted to do something, it's the general consensus, and they all had to agree. And Elvis is all by himself. And I think when he was an only child, like I am, I know this symptom well, he had, and I'll get to the generosity of the man in a second, and we can talk about this for 3 hours, but I won't, I promise. Elvis was all alone, and he got overpowered by people who were far more powerful. In the beginning, he was kind of naive, 1920, 21, 22, 23. And then he started to catch on to what they were doing. They were starting to squeeze him. There was a blackmail going on against Colonel Parker for the gambling debts, but also they realized who he was, and they were going to expose him. So when Elvis dies in 77, there's only $1 million in his bank account. Now think about this. The Recording Industry Artists of America calculated roughly that Elvis Presley sold 6 billion records with a B, billion. Now, they started tabulating after Elvis was already popular. So they really can't get an accurate account of all the records that were made. Now, if he made 25 cents off 6 billion records, you do the math. Where's all the money?
Right.
Something's going on here. So they were all being squeezed, all of them, every one of them. There's an invisible hand going on here, and it makes me sick to talk about it. Elvis was, and I'll get back to the only child thing, and I'll tell you why he was so generous with all of his wealth and everything. Elvis started to get to the point where he was a twin, and his twin died at birth. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And there are stories out there that he didn't die and he was sharing, you know, he was doing performances when Elvis wasn't, and they were performing in different places. Boy, Colonel Parker would have loved that.
Right.
True. But, so Elvis was racked with guilt his entire life. Why was I chosen to live and to have all this enormous fame and this enormous wealth? And, I mean, he was in therapy over it. It really bothered the guy. He said, why was I picked out of the trillions of lives to be Elvis Presley? So he almost felt he almost felt guilty over it. So he started to give things away. He was the most generous man we'll ever find.
Mm-hmm.
He gave away Cadillacs, gave away houses. He bought Jerry Schilling a house, one of Elvis's best friends from high school, bought him a house. He said, Jerry, you've never had a house of your own, and I want to be the one to buy it for you. It was one story. He was on a Cadillac dealership in California, and Sonny West told me the story. And he's in there, and he just decided one day he wanted a blue Cadillac with a white top. And he didn't care if he sold it tomorrow, he wanted it that day. So they roll into this Cadillac dealership, and they're trying to find one. And he's buying Cadillacs for all the guys. And this woman walked up, and you can tell she didn't have much, and spots Elvis through the window in the dealership. And she knocks on the window, and Elvis waves her in. So he's given her an autograph. Elvis not only bought 7 Cadillacs for his people that day, he bought a Cadillac for her, a Cadillac for her husband, and all 3 of their sons.
Awesome.
This guy would give... He would give rings off his fingers to people. He would give bracelets. He would give motorcycles. And I think all of this was driven from the generosity of, well, number one, he didn't have anything when he was growing up. Dirt poor.
Yeah.
And I think it got to the point where, you know, he just felt compelled to do this because part of it was guilt. You know, why was I meant to have all this? So he was just... You know, giving this, there was one situation where his jeweler, Lowell Hayes, happened to be at one of his performances, and Elvis told him, you know, go get the jewelry box. And he just handed out jewelry to everyone in the crowd. And they couldn't believe it. They said, do you have any idea how much money you just gave away? And he said, I'll sing 5 more minutes tomorrow night and make the money back. I mean, this is...
Exactly.
When he died...
You're making 125 grand a week back in the day. Money's good. It's all about cash flow, folks. Even if you're Elvis, it's about cash flow.
Yeah,
well, Stephen, I know it's getting late there on the East Coast. It's probably your 1 a.m. We're pushing that. So we will definitely, my friend, do this again with the other books. Folks, if you've been here, we are talking to the famed author Stephen Ubaney with this fantastic book, Who Murdered Elvis? And go to his website, whomurderedbooks.com. Is that right?
That's correct. That's it.
Perfect.
That's correct.
And folks, you got to get a hold of this book. I can't wait to read it. I'm a big Elvis fan, and I am a big fan of, I love a good mystery, and I love the intrigue and the era. I mean, I think your book should be made into a Hollywood movie. You know, I mean, it's
got
everything.
If there are any producers out there, Who Murdered Elvis should come out at the box office. You know, somebody
absolutely
on Hulu or someone like this should get a hold of these, and they should be made into a series, because I have all the evidence to back it up. These are not Easter Bunny stories. And when I found out Elvis Presley was murdered, I was heartbroken. I mean, I walked around for 8 months with a cloud over my head, and it was brutal. Not the book I wanted to write. Finally, one of my friends said, "You're going to have to tell everybody what happened." I said, "You're going to think I'm crazy." He said, "Yeah, but not all of them."
Nope, and not my audience, not our show, because I'll be honest with you, when I was a kid, I was, not that I'm overly cynical, but I questioned a lot. I was always the kid that said, I hear what you say, now I'm going to research it, now I'm going to look at it, now I'm going to analyze it. Not to analyze things to death, but I remember hearing the story, and I watch all the drama, right, unfold upon me, the women in the grocery store, I'll never forget it, crying. News came over the AM radio, everybody distraught. I mean, really distraught. I mean, grown men brought the tears. The level of Elvis fame, and people loved Elvis. But what I'm getting at is this is a real American story, and I'm so glad that you took the time to write this fantastic book, Who Murdered Elvis? And this should be a series, kind of like the Bill O'Reilly series, you know, the Killing series, where he has the one called Killing JFK, you know, Killing Lincoln, et cetera. Those books are fascinating, and I'm so glad you've taken the time to research this, Stephen, and bring this history to life. And I always suspected foul play with Elvis, because I said he was surrounded by so many people that, you know, I'm one of these people, I just don't always believe the official narrative. And everyone who knows me will say, yep, Von Weehunt will question it, because even 9/11, the Mandalay Bay massacre, which I agree with you, was very, very, very murky, very, very scary and nefarious. All these stories have come out in American pop culture and the real hard news, and I don't believe the official narrative on anything anymore, and I haven't for years.
You have people in this world who refuse, that their normalcy bias is so challenged by anything other than the official fiction that they have become reality challenged. I made up that word. I coined that phrase. They're reality challenged.
Love
that. To the point where they deny reality in front of them so devoutly, they have to blame it on a conspiracy theory. You know, when you're on the railroad track and you see the train coming at you, it's reality, it's not a conspiracy. Get the hell off the railroad tracks.
Right.
I work in a Las
Vegas. It's a runaway freight train.
I work in a Las Vegas.
And you know what, Stephen? The history of this country is a runaway freight train, and most people don't know real history. And you're right. They love to be – we all want to feel – cozy and comfortable. People love to be lied to, I believe. They love lies. They want to feel comfortable, you know?
I think that we've been taught to trust. I think Americans are very smart people. We're very generous people. 99.95% of people out there are wonderful people who wouldn't harm a fly. But we have to come to the realization of the fact that there are bad people in this world who do not share those values. And they walk among us. Back to the Vegas thing just for a second. I worked in security in a Las Vegas hotel. And I can tell you with almost absolute certainty, that did not happen the way we were told. I was a bike officer, and I could go to the edge of the parking lot, fold up a dollar bill, and back in 1996, they could take the cameras and they could read the serial number off that dollar bill. Then, you mean to tell me that they can't get to the bottom of this?
That's right.
I'm just going to summarize my comments on that because I don't go there. You know, I don't believe in every conspiracy, but I write about the ones I believe in. You know, I don't care if the Earth is flat or round. I just care that I'm on it. You know, I'll leave it there.
Stephen Ubaney, a pleasure having you on the Von Wiegand Show as we are in our official overtime. Our show is so jam-packed every week. We often go a half hour over, and I can per my contract with them. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. I'm so glad you were able to make the show and impart this valuable intel. And folks, again, whomurderedbooks.com is the website. Go there to buy your book or books. And the book is called Who Murdered Elvis? Stephen, it's been a real pleasure. Love to have you on again if you can make the show.
I'll make a special point of it. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and thanks for a great interview.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Stephen Ubaney, folks, and please hang on if you want. I'm going to take some calls, and we'll talk about your book. That's the theme tonight. Stephen, thank you so much, sir. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Fantastic interview. We're going to have a little bit of an intermission here. We're going to take some calls. A lot of calls are on the board. We're going to bring you on, and the author may stay with us for a little bit here. Get your adult beverage. We're in official overtime of the Von Wiegand Show. I don't have an Elvis song for you tonight, but I have something from the same era I think you'll like, and I'll be right back. Tonight, those of you who are still with us all over the world, and this podcast, I expect, will go through the roof. On these calls tonight, we're in overtime, so we don't have time to belabor the point too much or go down too many rabbit holes. Please keep your comments brief. I want you to praise the show, if you like, and our great VIP guest, author Stephen Ubaney. Stay with the theme. We're only talking about the book tonight. We're not going to go into all kinds of other political rabbit holes or discussions. We're not going to talk about the New World Order. That's for a different show. So tonight, please keep your comments pointed. Understand we are up against the clock. And we will go right down the list and see who's with us for our brief comments. Comments about Elvis, maybe his life. I want to hear some stories maybe where you were when Elvis died. What was the reaction of people? What happened? What transpired? So we'll start with the gunslinger in Texas. He's been on hold for quite a while. Gunslinger, are you still awake out there?
Oh yeah, we have a night. We have a night owl over here in Texas. Can you hear me?
Me too, man. I come alive at night. So, do you have any stories about Elvis or his what happened? Where were you when Elvis died? We'll start right there.
Well, two quick points there. I did get the pleasure of touring through Graceland one time back in the early 90s. And I remember seeing the big iron gates and the walls and all this stuff. And I'm going, whoa, you know, we went through the whole complete thing, even across the street where the jet was sitting and his museum. And I mean, it was just Elvis lived out there because Elvis music plays out there 24/7. Okay. It was really fantastic. It was really fantastic place to see.
Cool.
And your guest there is absolutely mind boggling. I never knew this stuff about Elvis.
Okay. I know. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah, I mean, I think what year did he die? In the early 70s, I think, somewhere in there.
It was August. I know Elvis died August 16th. That was a friend's birthday of mine. I believe 1977.
Yeah, I was just getting out of grade school. Okay, so you know, I've heard of Elvis, But I never was, old enough to be back growing up in that, era for that type of music. But later on, yeah, I love Elvis' music. I mean, he's got great, great songs, absolutely. But I never knew about the connection with the mafia. Oh, my God, I'm sitting here almost fainting in my chair. I'm going, wow.
Isn't that amazing? Well, yeah,
that,
I mean.
That's just that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. Elvis did die August 16th, 1977, per Google. I just checked it out for us. I was right.
Well, yeah, you tried. Well, one more quick point. I know you're limited on time there. With the mafia connection, this is fantastic because you know where Arlington, Texas is over there? There was a strip club over there.
I used to live in Arlington, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you remember Fantasy Ranch over there by Six Flags?
Yes, the strip club.
Yeah.
Yes.
My buddy of mine,
I
his
probably
wife
saw,
worked up
Gunslinger, I probably saw you there a few times in the late 80s when I was there.
Yeah. I spent plenty of dollar bills over there.
Hey, I got to interject this. This is a great juxtaposition from going from Who Murdered Elvis to Fantasy Ranch in Arlington. And
it kinda, well,
guys,
it,
if you don't know. Gunslinger, let me say this. Just hang on. Guys, if you don't know, Fantasy Ranch was one of the premier strip clubs. It's called the Mid-Cities region of the DFW Metroplex. Gunslinger and I know it well. They had little rooms, and it was rumored to be mafia-owned and controlled. And boy, did they put on one hell of a show. Okay, back to you, Gunslinger.
Okay, well, with the mafia connection, I can guarantee that place was mafia controlled, and I'll tell you why. Because a buddy of mine, his wife worked out there as a cosmetologist, doing the girls' makeup and everything. And back in the day, I was doing electrical work. Okay, and I said I asked the buddy's wife. I said, "Hey, take a couple of my cards out there and give it to the boss or the head person. I'd like to do some of this maintenance on this stage lighting. You know, it's part of electrical work." And his wife came back and said, "Mark, you don't want no part of this." I said, "Why?" I said, "All these strip clubs are owned by the mafia, every one of them." So that just confirmed that they're all owned by the mafia. And I said, "Whoa,
yes.
I don't want part of that." No, thank you.
And let me say say you something. When I went down to Texas after college, I wasn't born there, but I love Texas. Word on the street was what Gunslinger just said. There's always been the mafia in the Southland, and the Italian mafia ran those Texas strip clubs. And there was also the Dixie Mafia that often gets overlooked. They were the Southern boys who were basically a mafioso among themselves. And so you had the Texas Dixie Mafia, and you had the big crime family mafia, you know, from Las Vegas, where they were expanding their tentacles all over the country, right? But yeah, that was widely known, and I met a lot of them when I was, as a young buck, when I went into those clubs. Boy, did we have a good time. And I hit Texas Gunslinger at the right time. I went there in 1988, and it was booming, and it was pre-COVID Americana. I had job offers all over the table. I couldn't have picked a better place to go to, man, than the DFW area. It was booming. Women were everywhere. It was like L.A. probably in the 60s. Women were everywhere in Dallas in the 80s. They were just picking off a tree, picking apple off the tree. And they all wanted to go out with you, and they were all gorgeous. And you got, as a young buck, you got hooked on those Texas girls. Oh, my God. I came there staying, man, but I broke out, and I came back out west where I belong, where my roots are. Go ahead, man.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that was just the correlation between the mob there, because I didn't really believe it. I thought, you got to be kidding me. She said, no, not just Fantasy Ranchers owned by them. They're all the ones up there off of Mockingbird and Harry Hines,
right,
and Northwest Highway up there in Dallas. She said they all are owned by the mafia, every one of them. I said, whew, I'm glad I missed that one.
Well, there was a thing called the Dallas Mafia when I lived there, and that was code for the real mafia. And they were real. There's a lot of money. The mob goes wherever there's a lot of money, whether it's Elvis Presley. There was always a lot of money in Dallas, a lot of easy cash. What a great place to set up shop. Hmm? Great place to launder money. Great place to, a lot of shows there, a lot of entertainers there. Amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's it. Thanks for having a nice night, and great for you to be up
here. Thank you so much, man. So that show rocks your world, huh?
Yeah.
Sure love is. That. Very have good. A great night, bud. Have a great night. Yeah, this is we're getting into our winter VIP series where during the winter months, I tend to bring on the VIP. During the summer and that, I kind of just want to hear from the American people, but we'll have some more people on. Let's now get to Paul the Gladiator and his North Valley compound. We get a few comments from the Gladiator. How you doing, man?
Oh, yeah, man. I'm gladiating, you know. I will,
what are your thoughts on the
Elvis
Presley interview tonight?
Oh, yeah, man. Michael's great. Definitely got to go to his website and grab some books for Christmas. Joe Biden cannot stop that book supply. So definitely go to whomurderedbooks.com and you get your books by Christmas. So go buy some Christmas gifts. You know? Yeah, that was amazing. So I have a really I'll tie it in with Elvis because I know somebody who actually knew Elvis Presley in Las Vegas, and my mother, she ran the Boston Elvis Club. I have a safety deposit box. In that safety deposit box is kind of one-third of my 401k, quote-unquote, right? It is... every LP 33 and every 78 original Elvis records in their folders, my mother's entire collection, plus two scarves from the Hilton International shows that Elvis did in the very early 70s.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, priceless, man.
I think I told you that story a couple of years ago, but yeah. So when my mother passed away, you know, me and my sister just, you know, we're like oil and water. I said, look, you got everything. Mm-hmm. But I told my mother when I was a little boy, because my mom would play Elvis every day around the house, right?
Mm-hmm.
I said, the only thing I ever want is that Elvis collection. I want nothing. And even when I was older, in my teens, in my 20s, in my 30s, in my 40s, I always told my mom, I only want the Elvis collection. You can give the rest to her, right? And
mm-hmm.
And that's the only thing I got when she passed. So that, and when Elvis died, the day he died, I was in school, and I was a little boy. I lived across the street from the school. My mom ran the PTA, the Parent Teachers Association. She was the president of the PTA. And
mm-hmm.
the day Elvis died, one of the teachers came into my class, said, go home, go walk home. We know your mother's in pain right now. And she's the one that told me, Elvis Presley has died. You need to walk across the street, go home. My mother was in her room with the door closed for one solid week, 7 straight days. I remember it. It was one of my most vivid memories as a real
wow.
young boy in elementary school. And I was in fifth grade when that happened. So
wow.
that, and then here in Arizona, one of my vice presidents of a corporation I worked for, who I was very close with, he, as a young man, was in Las Vegas. He actually helped the developer open up the Jockey Club, which was one of the very first timeshares, and the Polo Towers, the second timeshare. He worked directly with the developer. He lived in a 3-bedroom apartment. He had 2 roommates. He opened up the timeshares in selling them. One of his roommates got the very first, and still has it, very first limousine licenses, and he still runs that limousine company to this day. The third roommate, the youngest of the three, who was a pretty big guy, his first job in Las Vegas was to go to the airport and meet and greet and then personally bodyguard every time Elvis Presley came into town. He was
wow.
the front bodyguard man, right? And I met him because mm-hmm. I was going to start a business in Las Vegas with a friend of mine who at the time was the VIP host of the Pure Nightclub at Caesars a few years back. We brought them mm-hmm. to a meeting at a restaurant. We presented a business opportunity to the three of them to finance us. And he would, you know, we became very friendly that weekend, and he told me a couple of stories about him being Elvis's bodyguard. And then,
mm-hmm.
you know, years later,
wow.
back then, this was about 5-6 years ago, when I met him, he was then one of the top pit bosses of the Bellagio. Now, I believe he's retired right now because of COVID. He took a
okay.
retirement, I believe. But he was Elvis Presley's personal bodyguard from his first contract at the Hotel International, which became the Hilton later, all the way through till the last day he ever performed in Las Vegas. That was his job, and he got paid very well by Elvis and his father to do that.
Wow.
He was physically fit, but he was also trained. You know, one of the early trained men as being a personal bodyguard in the late 60s all the way through the early 80s, actually, because he did bodyguard other people as well when they came in town. So, yeah, 2 kind of very cool stories, keeping with the Elvis theme. But, yeah, let me tell you.
Very cool stories.
You know, a lot of people think that the record collection and scars that I have are worth, you know, crazy buco money. But You'd be surprised. They're really not worth that much because of the of what was said in your interview. They printed so many of these, you know,
right.
I mean, 6 million records divided by, you know, 50 is still, you know, like 600,000 each, right, of each album. So they're not super rare. It's just super rare to have the whole collection together, which does bump it up, but it's not, I mean, it's not a crazy dollar figure. Because if it was, I would have sold it, built a house in a mountain. No one would know who I am anymore, right? I mean,
exactly.
You know that about
no, it's still, it's still have, but you're right. They did mass produce that stuff. But together, you know, there's always an Elvis collector out there to this day who will give you some good coin for it. So, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And you're right about your parents. I know my parents were big Elvis fans, too. My mother and father had Elvis Presley records, the originals, and they were really into Elvis and Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass, who I love to this day, that 1960s go-go music, you know. And they were really into Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett. They loved the crooners and like movie show things. But they were really into Elvis. And I know when my parents were shell-shocked. I mean, my dad, I told everyone he met Elvis back in the day. I think I told the story once on the radio, but I'll be really, really brief. My dad was working at a filling station as a boy. And, you know, back then people forget the economy was really different and really hard. People collected nickels, dimes, and quarters. And you know this, Paul. And so money was tight. Not everybody was living high off the hog, you know, except Elvis, right? But my dad saw this bus pull up. This is in the late 50s before Elvis got really popular, and saw these guys come out looking like rockabilly guys playing baseball, you know, while they were working on, they were airing up the bus tires, and my dad was there pumping gas. He had just gotten out of the Air Force for his first stint. Back then they would let you out for 2 or 3 months if you wanted to go on a vacation or do something different, and they would take you back into the Air Force. Well, my dad took off for a while. He was, you know, this after the war in Korea. And he said, who are these guys? And who are they? They look different. And the guy goes, yeah, there's, he said, I'm not sure, but they're doing some barnstorming around here. And, you know, they were doing barnstorming in Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Arkansas area. And the guy goes, one of them's Elvis. And one of them is like, you know, some other names that probably just got lost to a time, who made it and who didn't. But my dad walked up and my dad saw Elvis playing ball. That's how they would unwind, right? Get out of the bus and they would start playing baseball, catch. And my dad met Elvis there and he saw this young dapper guy and he kind of talked with that, you know, that draw. And he goes, what's your name? The guy goes, I'm Elvis Presley, sir. I'm Elvis Presley. I'm going to be famous someday. Anyway, very cool story, but amazing stuff, man. Paul, it's just amazing, you know?
You know, my interesting story, and I can show you one day. I'll show you photos. You'll be pretty impressed of the similarity, but my mother used to tell friends and people stories at parties. The only reason why she married my father was because he actually resembled Elvis. Now, my father had black hair, big black hair over the top. He had big, long sideburns and dark hair. And, you know, my heritage is a lot of American Indian. And he had kind of that American Indian tonality, you know. And, you know, it's funny because everybody's like, you know, everybody looked like that in the 50s, but my mom was like, no, but he kept it in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. My father kept that look. And when we used to go to Vegas as children, because I was one of the first children to go to Vegas, Circus wasn't even built the year before I went, and then the second year and on it was, my mother was a Rockette dancer, 16 to 20 years old, lied about her age, and she made her own fashionable clothes. You know, she had her own fashion label. And he made my father a silver lamé-type tuxedo for Vegas. My mom would make gowns and crazy stuff. And we would go out to dinner. Me and my sister would be all dressed up. Women would attack my father because he would wear these big sunglasses and with his big hair and his sideburns. And he was in really good shape. He was, you know, 6'2", had the same frame. And so women would attack because they would wonder, like, who's the woman with him? Like, and she was all flashy, fashionable, big hair, you know, her own sunglasses. And me and my sister would be strolling behind, like, look at these women. They're idiots, you know? Like,
this is my parents we're talking about here. Come on. I love it.
Hilarious. Dude.
So cool.
Crack up, you know?
Good stuff, man.
We used to go to Vegas 3 times a summer in the early 70s and mid 70s. So, you know, back then, you look like Elvis and you're at the pool with sunglasses or you're out with a tuxedo that's silver, you know, people are going to be like, who is that? You know, is that Elvis? Like, and they, and women would like group up and run. You know, it's funny as hell.
I love it. That is funny as hell, man. Thank you, Paul. Have a great night from one Elvis fan to the other, man. Appreciate you, man. Okay. Thanks so much. Great stories. See, that's what I want. I want to get some good anecdotal stories here. Well, we have time for one more call, and I know Brett the Surfer has met Elvis before. Of course, that's what I think he's told me that before in some of his surfing expeditions. And we got Brett on the line here, but we first will play a little song for him. Surfer on for his comments on Elvis Presley sticky to our theme tonight.
All right, Vaughn. Love that.
How
love
you
that
doing,
song,
man?
I'm doing great. And yeah, I've seen Elvis out in, you know, I've seen him out there. I've been out surfing and some guy with black hair, greased back, trying to catch my wave, stealing my wave, you know. I don't know. I might have been mistaken.
Yeah. Elvis, back off. You know? Breath waves, man.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what's your
yeah.
good Elvis Presley story tonight?
Well, I remember when that I was probably, I don't know, probably about 10 and a half years old, I think, given away my age. But, yeah, I just remember how the crime, you know, of not my mom. My mom liked Elvis, you know. My dad was like, my dad just was like, you know, he wasn't really, I don't know. He was just like, they went to an Elvis concert actually in down in Phoenix, old Coliseum down there. And, it was at the fair. He was actually at the fair. That was to see him. But
wow.
I remember when he died. Yeah, that was back in probably 59.
1957, August. I have the exact date.
When they saw him down at the Coliseum, it was probably 1958.
Oh, I see. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Right. 77.
Yeah. But it was that day was I just remember the crying, I really didn't know the whole catalog of all the songs, but I knew a couple, at that age. And I was really affected by it, even though I didn't know all of his music, I mean, the songs that I did know, I was like, oh, that's a great song, and just the energy that he had. Again, I was only 10 and a half, but,
I agree.
Caller you had though tonight, that's some very interesting information.
Wasn't the author amazing, Stephen?
Yeah.
Ubaney, fantastic. Interview with him, and I really appreciate him. Let me tell you one of my Vegas stories with Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
When I was a little kid, we drove from California, where I was raised, in Sacramento and Anaheim, and then my dad got transferred to Las Vegas. There's an Air Force Base called Nellis Air Force Base north of the Strip, where they have Area 51, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's also other areas up there that I know that are top secret. They go beyond Area 51. Okay, well, my father was in a lot of things back then, and I think he worked there, but he never really said that. But anyway, we lived on the Las Vegas Strip as a kid, and I remember driving into town. And we're just driving in. It's the mid-70s, and I see Elvis Presley on some of the marquees. I think we drove right by the International where he was playing. And I remember seeing Sonny and Cher, Dean Martin and the Gold Diggers. Big fan of Dino. He was playing, I believe, at what is now, it was back then it was called the Aladdin. But I remember all the old Strip and what it looked like. I have photographs of the old Strip. But Elvis was plastered around that town. And as a kid, I wanted to go to an Elvis Presley show. And also Dino.
Wow.
And, but my thing was, I remember the people, the hippies, the young people there. And I was a kid looking and I was going, wow, I can't wait to be an adult where I can start partaking of all this stuff, right? I couldn't wait to grow up. And when you're a kid, it takes forever to go from one year to the next. I'm going, it's like scratch down a chalkboard or something. It just takes forever. But my point was, Elvis was everywhere. He was omnipresent. Even back then, there were Elvis impersonators on the Strip, there was, and still is today, you go to Vegas, there's a 1950s Elvis.
Oh yeah.
If you want the young Elvis, they have my favorite is a 1968 comeback special Elvis in black leather. That's my favorite.
Oh yeah.
That's the coolest.
Yeah.
And I remember watching that show on TV, as a little guy, a little tyke. And my memory started at a very early age, and they showed showed that show throughout the 70s as a well. And they would replay it, the Elvis Comeback Special. And whenever it was on, it was kick-ass. And I loved the stage show. I own it on DVD to this day. It was a collectible that I said, I got to buy that before they stop making this stuff. Because, folks, if you're into Elvis or anybody else, you got to buy the stuff now, because with the new generation, millennials, Generation Z and Y and XYZ, et cetera, these kids don't even know who Elvis Presley is, a lot of them. And the big corporations are going to stop making this stuff eventually. It's going to, it's going to phase out eventually, though they're still making sales. But I hear that it's starting to they hit their peak, in other words, and starting to wane a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
But you'd be surprised at how many people, young, old, and indifferent, are still big Elvis fans. And they're out there.
Yeah.
And every year,
it's
kind of like
timeless.
New fans come up,
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he's a very unique. His voice is very unique, and just the way that you know, his performance, it was really something special, you know. But I don't know. I mean, you have the Mafia and the FBI gunning for you, you know. It's a scary situation. Yeah, scary to be in, you know.
It really is. Well, Brad, thanks for calling the show. Thanks for being an Elvis Presley fan and a fan of the author.
Yeah, of course.
And I'm glad I wanted to bring him to even a wider audience. Stephen Ubaney, Who Murdered Elvis, folks, get that book. I got mine coming. I've already ordered mine off his website. It's coming. And the author was so kind to send me an autographed copy of Who Murdered Diana. So I've got two of the series. Keep on going and follow his career, as I'm sure he'll follow mine. He's definitely a VIP guest before. I like how he tied everything together. I sat here riveted like you guys in the audience. For once, it was fun to be in the audience and just sort of prep the show, get it ready. We always have things to say, but I tell you folks, I believe in the big mix. We got to mix up the show, keep it new, keep it fresh. We've had a lot of calls. We had the other callers we can't get to you tonight. Some of them dropped off when I said that. they want to come on, but this is – once in a while, we'll have a show, and going forward, we want to stick to the themes of the show. We don't want to deviate too much from the movie script, if you will, from the Elvis Presley Hollywood movie script. You know, we're going to stay on target, and with that, we're going to end the show. Brett, thanks so much, man. Have a wonderful night, buddy. Good talking to you.
All right, Vaughn. Love it. Good show, man.
Thanks, man. And we'll do more of these. We're going to have Stephen come back on, talk about Who Murdered FDR, I think, next. Be a great World War II segment. I always believe there was foul play there as well. They wanted to get FDR out of the way, but before they could divide Europe after the fall of the Third Reich and get that going. And that's also an amazing tale of politics and geopolitics, international intrigue. But also Elvis is nothing but international intrigue. My God. He's still selling records today. He is still selling T-shirts today and sunglasses and lunchboxes, and the list goes on and on. I still walk into stores and see bedding or pillowcases with Elvis's impression. If I got a nickel off every item, I'd be a billionaire. It's just amazing, the merchandising around that man. A cult icon, pop culture, great hero and patriot of America. He's one of our best, and we love him. And he's up there right now enjoying the show, I'm sure, with Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and all the rest that were taken from us, like JFK and others that were taken from us far, far too soon. Folks, thanks for listening to the show tonight. We will do more of these VIP shows, and we love overtime because we can expand the show a little bit. Thank you very much as I broadcast from my mountain stronghold in the deep mountains of Arizona. I shall return next Thursday night. Never fear. Have a great night. God bless. And go Elvis Presley, wherever you are. We love you, man.